Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello. This is the Tennis Podcast, brought to you, as always, in association with The Telegraph, by myself, Catherine Whittaker, by David Law. We remain in disparate parts of the United Kingdom while tennis continues to take place, 7,000 miles away from us in various parts of the Far East, where the weather looks significantly better than it does here. There have been several winners on the WTA and ATP tours this week. Bits and bobs of news. Not a lot of admin-based tennis news this week, David. The listeners are going to be disappointed. That's what people tune in for.
Well, you say that. Simon Briggs saw the headline on last week's show, which was something like The State of Tennis Politics by Simon Briggs, and he queried whether it would be the least viewed or listened to show in the history of the Tennis Podcast. I can inform him that absolutely not. People wanted their political news brought to them by Simon Briggs of The Telegraph. So, it was listened to. But, yeah, fortunately, we can get back to hitting balls over nets, which, in fact, I did last week myself, Catherine, in an epic. Did you hear about my epic?
I saw you. You tweeted something. It's tweeted in a lot of detail about a scoreline and requested a GIF to accurately summarise the scoreline. And I found myself trawling through the ATP WTA results app thinking, what match is he talking about? Like, that didn't happen. Where was this drama that I missed?
Yeah,
it took quite a long time for the very disappointing other shoe to drop.
Yeah, it was me and my friend Simon, not that Simon, who I've never actually played, Simon Briggs, yet, but I did play my mate Simon.
I suspect, David, he would beat both of us.
That's the gauntlet has been thrown down. Not only am I going to get revenge against you, I am going to defeat Simon Briggs next time I see him. But yes, I've never beaten this guy who I played the other day, and I got to match point twice, and I still failed to convert. So
did you choke?
Did I choke? Do you know what is choking? If you think to yourself, God, I'm playing well today, I tell you, you know,
you get on those two match points, David? Were you beaten fair and square? Did you play good points where you had no regrets?
No.
did you double fault with a ball that bounced before the net?
No, I've given that up now. I've stopped that.
Right.
But I did.
You realise that was not an effective tactic.
Put it this way, I didn't play as well ahead as I did behind. I mean, that is something both of us were doing a lot. And that happens in the pros, doesn't it? So
it's interesting,
why is that?
Isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, well, the good news, David, I made a mental note to mention this on the podcast at the time and then didn't because there was all sorts of jazz going on in actual tennis. But there was another podcast I listened to a while ago about choking. And I'm desperately now going through my podcast app, David, to try and find it so I can give it its appropriate dues. But basically, long story short, a lot of research done into choking, a lot of psychological research. I think they used a slightly more finessed word than choking. But it is, you're more likely to choke the more intelligent you are.
Oh, really? Oh, well, I'm a genius.
Correlation between intelligence and choking is the bottom line.
Oh, That's quite useful. Yeah. Well, anyway, the gift that I chose in the end, Catherine, was one of Andy Murray just sitting on his chair, roaring in clear frustration. Because that's what happened to me. I ended up losing 7-5 in the tiebreak. And so, on to the next one is all I can say. I think the real tennis world has been more successfully followed than my own this week.
I think, was it an episode of Freakonomics?
It was, radio? Yes.
It that's was right. Freakonomics, yeah. And what was the name of the famous golfer, David, that they used as their case study? Famous golfing choke.
Vandeveld, wasn't it?
There you go. Yeah,
they the chap who ended up knee high in the water, wasn't he?
Yes.
When he was and about he led, to win the Open,
it was a mere technicality, and he ended up losing. Why we choke under pressure, brackets, and how not to. An episode of the Freakonomics podcast from July the 19th.
What's the biggest tennis choke you've ever seen? At Tennis Podcast, ooh, let us know.
You know what's going to happen. We're going to get a load of people texting us saying, the use of the word choke is completely disrespectful. You can't say choke.
Okay, what is the biggest loss?
No, I'm still comfortable. I'm very comfortable with us using it, David.
Okay, all right. Well, there's been some belters.
The biggest tennis choke.
We'll have a think about it over the week.
Mean for poor Kyle Edmund, it's recency bias, but wasn't he 5-love up in the final set against Jack Sock in Paris last year?
That's right.
And Sock went on to win the whole title.
Poor old Kyle. But when is it a choke and when is it the other player just doing brilliantly, as my opponent clearly must have done the other day?
Well, golf is a better, it's the perfect example, isn't it? Because your play, other than psychologically, is not at all influenced by your opponent or opponents plural, whereas in tennis obviously they're providing you with the ball that you're hitting. The variables aren't as easy to seal off in tennis as they are in sports such as golf or figure skating, for example. Figure skating has seen, I've snuck figure skating into the podcast again, David. It's that time of year. You see some incredible chokes in figure skating. Biggest choke I've ever seen.
I'll give you a week, Catherine, to think about it.
What have you got? I just did a really good one off the top of my head. You've given me nothing.
Well, no, I haven't really got anything yet. So I need to, look, I'm a bit older than you, so it takes a bit of time for my grey matter to kick in.
Do you know what? There's one that I hope she wouldn't mind me saying this, because she said it on the record before, but Daniela Hantikova was it the Australian Open semi-final?
Yes, against Anna Ivanovic, wasn't it?
She was a set and 2-love up against Anna Ivanovic. And she said she lost her serve to go. I think she won the. Was she 6-love, 2-love? It was some. She was playing extraordinarily well. It was either 6-love or 6-1 first set. And then she was 2-love up. And I think 15-love. And then she lost 3 points in a row. And she said, in her mind, as preposterous as it sounds, she said, in her mind, she was like, it's over now. It's gone. It's gone away from me. I'm going to lose this. Yet the scoreline was still saying she's 6-love. 2-love, 15-40 or whatever it is, which is extraordinary. Wow. And she did end up going on to lose it. I mean, and she says she lost it. I mean, Ivanovic still had to beat her, all the caveats about not taking anything away. But, Daniela describes this enormous, from the outside, ridiculous shift mentally. She started thinking about it. She said she started thinking about the position that she was in and everything changed. Rather than, doing everything on instinct, she suddenly sort of went, oh, I'm a set and 2-love. It can only get worse from here.
Yeah, this is what happened to me at the Henley and Arden Tennis Club, where there was only me and this other person in the whole club. It was deserted. On a slightly unrelated note, you mentioned Kyle Edmund and that loss he had to Jack Sock. I read Jack Sock's record this year is something like 6 matches won, 19 defeats.
It is exactly that. Yeah, he's about to tumble to outside the world's top 150. It makes you, it's a real eye-opener about the ranking system, isn't it? Because he's barely won a match all year. Barely. And yet he's been top 20 for most of the year. He's been riding on his successes at the back end of last year in Paris, as we mentioned, and at the O2. He's been riding that through this year. That's been enough to float his ranking. So it's been a strange example of the ranking actually for pretty much the entirety of 2018, just not reflecting at all the level of tennis that he's been playing.
And he's 17 in the world right now, but yeah, I mean, his race is about 159 or something on the race for the calendar year.
Yeah, and if he doesn't do anything in Paris, and well, he's not going to be at the O2, but I mean, no one's going to be putting their house on him having any kind of run in Paris, are they? He is going to plummet. We'll probably be doing a pole vault about whether there has ever been a rankings plummet that severe before. You know, from one day to the next, he's gonna fall about 150 places.
Did you just propose a pole vault?
Well, actually, no. I already regret it because that's something that's scientific. I mean, that right. Greg Sharko of ATP fame, I'm sure, will produce that statistic.
At Tennis Podcast,
as and when it happens.
Anecdotally, what is the biggest rankings drop you can remember?
Please,
after a break?
Please, unscientifically, tell us the answer to an entirely scientific question.
After a breakthrough year, what is the biggest disappointment from a player the following season? At Tennis Podcast. So we got two. Chokes.
Jeannie Bouchard has to be up
Crikey,
there.
Crikey, yeah. Bouchard's up there. She's just gradually starting to rebuild it a little bit, isn't she? But then I also think part of that is that she's now accepted or been forced to accept that she can't enter all these big tournaments anymore. So she's entering tournaments with lower ranked players that she can probably have a better chance of beating. So, which is probably what she should have been doing anyway. Right, what's on the agenda, Catherine? Because we've just spent 11 minutes completely ignoring what Matt's put down for us.
Right then. Well, the tennis that's been happening in the Far East. Shall we start? Well, I was going to start with the women's, but since we've already mentioned Kyle Edmund and we're sort of generally vaguely in the men's zone, should we stay with that? Should we do Beijing? Should we wrap
Go for
up
it.
Beijing and Tokyo?
Why don't we?
Well, Beijing was won by Nicolas Basilashvili, who beat, the word I've seen a lot is an ailing Juan Martín Del Potro, definitely suffering with some kind of cold or flu. Probably a cold, but because he's a man, he's calling it the flu.
Oh, that's how we're saying it, is it?
Yes, yeah, it is.
Right.
Yeah, it's his second ATP 500 title of the season. He also won Hamburg. He beat Kyle Edmund in the semi-final. Good week for Kyle, definitely playing the kind of tennis he was playing at the Australian Open. You know, he's definitely been off on the hard courts, on the US hard courts, and leading up to the US Open. You know, I remember we interviewed him back-to-back, didn't we, on the eve of the US Open, and there was a couple of minutes in between while the Amazon camera crew was setting up, and I came over to you and I said, "Oh, you got any tips? Do you get anything out of him?" And you said to me, he's saying the right things, but you can tell that he's reaching, he's searching. Well, he definitely found it, I think, in Beijing last week. Really, really big week for him. However, he's still yet to win a title, isn't he? And let's face it, on paper, that was a really, really big opportunity for him. I'm sure psychologically he'll be leaving, you know, saying good week, brilliant, you know, positives far outweigh negatives. But it is just another little opportunity missed.
And I was thinking about this earlier today. I'm fairly sure about 6 months ago we had a similar conversation about Kyle, that he needs to get over this hump, that he is yet to... He's yet to reach a final, isn't he? Or is that right?
No, I think he reached the final this year. Didn't he reach the Rabat final?
Something like that. Yeah, he's yet to win a title.
Not Rabat.
That's it.
Morocco. So, yeah, he's yet to win a title,
and,
for sure.
And that just feels out of sync, really. You know, he needs to get that sorted one way or another. And I mean, I know that's stating the obvious, but here's a player who's just incrementally knocked down the barriers in front of him. He doesn't do one after another lots in a row, but he'll suddenly have a breakthrough, and he's there, and then he's comfortable in those surroundings, and that's the next one for him. The problem is he's now at a level of tournaments, as we were just saying about Bouchard. If you go the other way and you start getting into these better tournaments, it becomes harder to find tournaments that you can win without having to play way above your ranking and beat players ranked higher than you. But, you know, there will be tournaments. I don't know whether it's the early part of next year or whatever it might be now, but he needs to get a title win, because then you must surely feel differently when you're just holding a trophy. It must do.
Oh, I mean, without question. I mean, we see with players dropping down to play at challenge level just to get the feeling of winning matches again. You know, all the pros will say the old cliche about winning is a habit, and it doesn't matter what level the opponent is. It's the fact of winning somehow becomes a habit. So, and look, he's winning tennis matches again, and he's imposing his game again, which is most important. You know, Kyle Edmund is not going to win passive tennis matches, is he? So the signs are good, but you're right. It's an important hurdle, which I think needs to be overcome soon, because it's the old thing of, you know, accumulating scar tissue and baggage, isn't it? It's going to become an increasing thing in his own mind. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see what he does. Do we know what his plans are pre-Australian Open?
I haven't seen which sort of pre-events he's playing, because
not Hopman Cup, because that's Norrie and Bolter, isn't
correct,
it?
Correct, yes.
They've announced that. So be interesting to see what he does, whether he plays Sydney, whether he plans to play both weeks, that a week directly before Australian Open. You know, if I were him, I'd be eyeing a title there.
Incidentally, the player who beat him, Nicholas Basilashvili, and the chap who won in Tokyo, Daniil Medvedev, don't you just think they are two really impressive players who've made major strides this year, largely unnoticed? And they are the sort of player that get it done and nobody makes any fuss about them. I was looking at this rankings riser list that our colleague Nick Lester tweeted last night, I think, and it showed all the names that we're always talking about, like Stefanos Tsitsipas and Denis Shapovalov and Chung and all these sort of players. And, you know, then you look at Medvedev, and he's had just as impressive a rise, more so than some of them, and gets no real noise at all.
Yeah, because he's not, you know, he's not jazzy in the way that some of the other hashtag next gen are. I think is he just out of next gen this year? Is he? I'm not sure he's next gen this year. But anyway, in spirit, he's next gen. He's not, you know, he's not eye catching in the way that Shapovalov and Tsitsipas are. You know, he's not being sort of rammed down our throats from a PR perspective, is he? He's a Russian whose favourite surface is grass. No one really knows what to do with him, where to put him. And of course, he has had a couple of moments where he hasn't covered himself in glory.
No, his behaviour on court has been really questionable a couple of times, hasn't it?
Yeah, the throwing of the coins at the umpire was a particular low point, which we can't gloss over. But I'm pleased for him. I'm pleased he's just plugging away. And with these next geners, we've come to expect, you know, that it always has to be done via some extraordinary breakout week, like Shapovalov beating Nadal in Montreal, or, you know, Tsitsipas having a similar breakthrough this year. But no, it can be done incrementally. And that's sort of more his style, isn't it? Daniil Medvedev, far more his style. And to beat Kei Nishikori in Tokyo, blimey. He beat Nishikori in the final in Tokyo to win the biggest title of his career. Incidentally, his third title, Medvedev.
Exactly.
I don't want to harp on about Kyle's deficiencies, especially when it was fundamentally a very good week for him. But that puts it in some context, doesn't it? That someone like Medvedev, who we don't even think of as having had his big breakout moment yet, he's already won three titles.
And he's gone from 84 in the world at the end of last year to currently 22 in the world, which is not far off what Tsitsipas has done, 91 to 15 in the world. And I mean, we're always talking about Denis Shapovalov. He's gone from 51 in the world to 29. So a much more gentle ascent for Shapovalov this year, who has been at times a little disappointing, as exciting as he's been. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, it's been a disappointing year for him, without question. He had that big week in Madrid, didn't he? But apart from that, it's a struggle to find standout results from him. Did you see the match point he had against Nishioka? Was it Nishioka? Yeah, Nishioka last week.
No, I didn't. I think you mentioned it to me, but I didn't actually get around to asking you what happened.
Oh, I mean, he put a volley that you or I could have made.
Let's not exaggerate.
Outside the tram lines.
Okay. Oh, dear. That's
And went that's on nice. To lose all remaining games and lose the match. Yeah, it was the sort of miss which can get into your head.
Mm. He's still on the rise, but it feels like he's got a bit of work to do, really.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think he will maybe be pleased to see the end of the season and get the chance to have a bit of a regroup. But then, you know, before he knows it, the 2019 will be here and goodness, there'll be pressure then. But anyway, end of season first. A couple of other players who've risen here,
Catherine. Alex de Minaur has gone from 208 in the world to 33 in the world. Francis
and
Tiafoe
still looks like a 12-year-old.
He does. Francis Tiafoe has gone from 79 to 40, who I think de Minaur has got further strides to make as well. I think there is a top 20, top 15 player in there. I think Tiafoe will scrape into the 20s, but I don't think he's going a whole lot higher than that. It's quite interesting that both Brad Gilbert and I've seen Marty Fish has been very vocal about Tiafoe's potential, as has Patrick McEnroe. I think he's a great mover and he hits the ball incredibly hard, but I really do see a ceiling to his game.
The technique is funky, isn't it? Mm. Particularly on the forehand, it's funky technique. He gets a lot of return from it. He gets a lot out of it because of the power he applies, but it doesn't feel efficient tennis to me. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's expending a heck of a lot of energy to get that power on the ball. It's not easy power, is it? It's effortful power somehow. And yet he's a naturally great mover. He's obviously a very fit guy and seems very committed to his tennis, which is good to see. But yeah, I think there's a natural technical ceiling in a way that there might be a sort of physical ceiling for de Minaur. But I don't know. He's not the man he's going to be yet, is he? I don't know what he's going to look like in 4 years. I think he might be unrecognisable. Do you know what I mean? Like, he can't continue to look 12 years old forever.
You know how I've been asking everybody to tell me a good box set to watch recently? I can imagine.
Found one, David, don't you, David? You found one.
I found one. Friday Night Lights, folks.
And you were ashamed to tell me about it. And
well, I thought you would diss me.
Yeah,
I thought
watched you would, all of it in about 6 days.
I thought you would love be it. Scathing, and I was. I mean, I think
a sports-based TV drama, David.
Yeah,
I
thought it wasn't going to be worthy enough, to be honest. And I actually let a whole night pass before admitting it. and then when I did, you told me you were delighted with it. So
very, very supportive of your efforts, David.
I was thrilled. Anyway, I could imagine Alex de Minaur not looking out of place in one of those shows where you're, you know, in a high school. I mean, he's probably past high school.
Yeah, but he would be the kid that, you know, in all of these high school dramas, they all are like 28 playing 17-year-olds. He looks too young. He looks too much like a real school kid.
He does. He does. He does look like
to actually play a school kid.
A character in Neighbours. Do you know what Neighbours is? Is that?
I do know what Neighbours is. Yeah, of course I know what Neighbours is. Right, I watched Neighbours in its heyday.
Heyday?
Yeah.
Its heyday was when Jason Donovan and Kylie Minogue were in it. Did you watch it when they were around? Were you alive?
I'd say the heyday was like the Kennedys, when the Kennedys first arrived. And anyway, there are some American people that listen to this podcast, David, and they are tuning out in their droves.
They're in it for the Friday Night Lights bit.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
What were you going to say? I can't remember. It was about 10 minutes ago.
It was a while ago. I was maybe going to mention... do you remember when Nicolas Basilashvili won one game in three sets against Rafael Nadal?
Yes, at the French Open last year, wasn't
it? Yeah. I mean, other weaker human beings might have just, you know, burned all their tennis rackets and given it up. And a few people were after he won the title in Beijing, were circulating quotes from his press conference after that defeat. And one person, it just says who the questioner was in the transcript, but basically asked him, are you ashamed? You know, do you feel dirty? They said, do you feel the need to sort of go and have a shower straight away to wash away the grime of that performance? So, getting beaten by Nadal in Paris soundly, there's no shame in that. But one game in three sets, I mean, you could be waking up having nightmares for quite a long time, couldn't you? So, I'm pleased for him. He's another one that belts the ball.
Yeah, well,
absolutely, and that, belts it.
That does appear now to be all he goes out and seeks to do, is just destroy tennis balls. And looking at his ranking history, it's quite interesting to watch a player's trajectory in this way. He spent 2 years knocking around 100 in the world, and then he managed to break through and get into the sort of 50 to 100 level, and he was there for a year and a half, and he's now got himself to a career high 23 in the world. So, you know, that's a really good rise that he's made this year. He's 26 years of age now, as Basilashvili. So who knows? Who knows what the future may hold for him? But great week for him winning in Beijing. What about the women's tournament in Beijing?
Well, Caroline Wozniacki, of course, it's a Premier mandatory in Beijing for the women. So it's a bigger event
tournament, isn't it? Yeah.
For the women than it is for the men. And there's only four Premier mandatories. So Beijing's a big deal, and completely out of nowhere, Caroline Wozniacki had Australian Open aside, the week of her year, didn't drop a set, beat Sevastova in the final 6-3, 6-3 to win her third title. I mean, completely out of nowhere.
She has rather done nothing between the Australian Open now.
Yeah, I mean, incredibly impressive, but and jarring, I think, and really made me reevaluate her a bit, because I think of her as a real like groove form player. I didn't think of her really as somebody that could just sort of turn it on out of nowhere, but boy did she do that this week. It was an interesting week, wasn't it? Qiang Wang, real success for Chinese players, which is great to see. No, most notably, Qiang Wang. We're saying Wong, aren't we? They were saying Wong in commentary.
That's correct. Do I need
to start saying Wong?
You do, yeah.
Wong Qiang.
Correct. Correct.
Wong Qiang. Were you going to correct me before I corrected
myself? No, I'm too shy. And also, right. I did go Wong commentary. I'm ashamed to say it, but I did go Wong commentary, calling the same player three different things in the course of a commentary. But anyway.
Which player was it, David? Come on.
Oh, crikey. Who was it? It was...
Was it Lara Arruabarena?
No, actually, it was Sevastova, stroke Sevastova. Stroke something else I can't even remember, but I definitely called her three things. And actually, at one point, I just alerted the viewers, look, we're going to settle on this, because she's saying that, I'm saying this, and it might be a third option. So anyway, we'll go with one or the other. Yes, Wozniacki, the other thing is, I think she has just had a lot of niggly injuries, and she's one of those players that she cannot play if she can't move at 100%. There's no chance she's going to beat players just, I don't know, either by finessing them off the court or blasting them off the court. She's got one way of playing tennis, really, and it's about grinding. And I don't mean that as a criticism of her, but it was quite jarring to look at her record for the year, this year, when I was commentating on her in Wuhan, and to think, here's the Australian Open champion, and she still hadn't qualified at that point for Singapore. You know, it was still up in the air at that point. If she hadn't have had, and obviously she's made it now comfortably, but yeah, I mean, if I look at her year here, after the Australian Open, I think she had a good run for a little while after that. She made the semis, absolutely brilliant run in Doha semis. She managed to beat Kerber. But then after that, in Indian Wells and Miami, she didn't get past the fourth round. She didn't do much on the clay, as per usual. It's not her favourite service. Didn't make a semi-final on the clay at all. Won at Eastbourne. And then after that, second round Wimbledon, second round Montreal, second round Cincinnati, second round US Open, second round Tokyo. And a lot of these are byes. So she was just not winning matches at all. And then Wuhan, she got beaten by Monica Puig. I commentated on that match, and she just got knocked off the court. And then here she is, winning Beijing, beating Belinda Bencic, Petra Martic, Annette Kontaveit, Katerina Siniakova, Wong Qiang, and then Anastasia Sevastova, 6-3, 6-3 in the final. Didn't lose a set. I mean, that is mightily impressive.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. And it's been a long time, isn't it, since she won a Premier Mandatory. Was it 2011? Did I see that stat? It's been a long time since she won a Premier Mandatory, certainly. So yeah, I mean, that's huge, let alone, and I before last week, when it became apparent that victory had qualified her for Singapore, I had just sort of mentally assumed that she was there. I personally find it important for the end of year championships that all the Grand Slam champions from the year are present. Maybe that's old fashioned of me, but I think it's right.
It wouldn't feel right. No,
it wouldn't feel right. Yeah.
Last year we didn't have Sloane Stephens there because she'd had, obviously she'd had the very serious injuries in the first half of the year. But actually, the one player who's not going to be there unless there are withdrawals now is Aryna Sabalenka, who a week ago we thought might make it, but she was eventually knocked out by Wang, wasn't she, in the semi-finals.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant performance by Wong, and total drama, thrilling inputs from Peter McNamara in the on-court coaching department.
Such as?
Well, he's just incredibly honest. She's like, what do you want me to do? And he's like, I don't know. and there's a lot of, he's not afraid to talk about the opponent. A lot of the time, those on-court coaching exchanges, it's all to a fault introspective, isn't it? It's what you need to do. Don't worry about what she's doing. This is what you need to do. And he was all about, look, She's playing brilliant right now because she went 3-love up, didn't she, Sabalenka, at the start of the match and ended up losing in straight sets, 7-5, 7-5, I think it was. And he said, I think he came on at 3-love, you know, and he just said, look, you will get a chance. You will get a chance. This is how she rolls. Wait for your chance. Keep doing what you're doing and you'll get a chance. And lo and behold, it came. She was waiting for it. She was ready. She pounced on it. And then I think he came on at the end of the first set, you know, when it really felt important for her to hammer home that advantage and not let Sabalenka get a grip at the start of the first set. And he said, she is a confidence player. She's all about confidence. Don't let her get on a roll. It's imperative. He said, this next game is the most important one of the match. You have to win it. You can't let her get her foot back in the door because then it'll be all about her. And yeah, she sort of said, what can I do at that 3-love down about, you know, about the winners that she's hitting? And he just said, I don't know. You know, there's nothing you can do. And he's right. That sort of honesty is because Sabalenka is completely unplayable at her best, completely unplayable. So he just said, I don't know what you can do. Don't worry about that. Just have faith that you will get a chance, that she cannot keep that up and you will get a chance. Yeah, and it was really interesting. I personally am disappointed that chances of Sabalenka qualifying are fading because, you know, she's just so exciting and I would be very surprised, injuries aside, if she wasn't there next year. You know, she's a top eight player, isn't she, already? Really. So, yeah, it's a shame. I still wouldn't rule it out. She's playing Tianjin. She's down to play Tianjin and Moscow next week. So, I mean, she's going to be exhausted at the end of the year,
isn't
she?
10th place she is currently. She does need a withdrawal, though. And
she does.
Simona Halep is the one who hurt her back, wasn't, and had to withdraw, wasn't she?
But she says there's no question of surgery and I'm definitely going to Singapore. Halep does. Mm.
Petra Kvitova also qualified, and Osaka, we know, is there. She's in fourth place for the year, but she had an eventful week as well, didn't she?
Goodness me, she did, yeah. She, the week started, but I think mere minutes, inconveniently, David, after our podcast recording last week, she did her pre-Beijing press conference, and she was asked by the assembled media about the incident. The incident, that seems reductive somehow, doesn't it? About what happened in the US Open final, and it was... It's pretty harrowing what she had to say, really, and the way she had to say it, that she doesn't like to think about it still, that it was incredibly difficult, and happy isn't how she feels when she thinks about it. And
bittersweet.
Bittersweet was the word she used, yeah. And she said that she thinks she did so well in Tokyo because it was a welcome distraction from the US Open. I mean, that's just awful.
What a shame.
She doesn't want to think about it. It's, I mean, the fact that she's channeling it so positively, or certainly did so in Tokyo. She didn't have a bad week in Beijing, did she? But she had a... Who was the match against, David? Remind me.
Which one?
When she got very, very upset. Emotionally.
Zhang Shuai. And,
Zhang Shuai, there we go.
Yeah, she had a three-set epic with her. And in the end, I remember her... It was a very warm embrace at the net. They're clearly very close. But she was quite apologetic, I think, about...
Yeah, she
about
was.
About the fact that she'd been showing her emotions in the match and that she'd been crying openly on the court, and it just seemed as though that moment it all became a bit too much for her. And she actually talked about her next match that she ended up losing, that even though she lost, she was just pleased that she behaved better. And it's quite an interesting mental case study at the moment, isn't it? Because I mean, Osaka is a different kind of personality to most players we've ever seen before anyway. I can't remember someone coming across quite like she does. And I don't really know what's going to happen from day to day with her. And it will be interesting to see what happens, because not only is her success rocketing at the moment, I've noticed how her social media channels have just gone off the scale. Every time, I mean, this was a woman who a year and a half ago, she had a few thousand followers on social media, and she was funny. Now she could sneeze on social media and it gets liked 4,000 times. You know, there's just an enormous reaction to everything
and
she
it,
does.
And is the nature of the content, David, how different is it? Is it all corporate advertorial / sponsored content, or does it still feel real? Does it still feel like her? Because that's
still
the crucial
real
thing for
it
me.
It still feels real to me. She still feels like she's having a laugh with it, which is fine. It's just that you sense it. You look at somebody's followers and it doesn't necessarily equate to how much interaction that person is getting on social media. She is getting almost the same kind of reaction to a tweet that Serena Williams is getting now, in terms of just engagement of people viewing it and responding to it.
Yeah, not everyone wants to see a topless Serena Williams singing "I Touch Myself," though, do they? Which is what we got last week on Serena Williams.
Wasn't that
social media? It was for a brilliant,
for some sort of
brilliant
cause, isn't it?
Cause.
I don't know what it was.
Brilliant cause, and I guess the fact that we're talking about it now is for breast cancer awareness.
Oh, right.
Brilliant cause, and I guess the fact that we're talking about it makes it justifies it in itself. However, I found it pretty startling. You not seen it?
No,
right.
I haven't.
It's Serena Williams a cappella singing "I Touch Myself."
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I've really felt like we were in the Twilight Zone when I was watching that.
I did read about it, but I haven't.
There were many things that happened last week that made me think that we'd finally, as a species, entered the Twilight Zone, and Serena Williams singing "I Touch Myself" was just one of those.
Indeed. Well, I tell you what, just a minor note here. I'm currently watching what it turns out are brief highlights of Bradley Klan against Nick Kyrgios. Kyrgios having taken the first set in Shanghai in the first round, and then Klan has won the second set. And I'm telling you, Kyrgios is not really trying. He's slapping at balls. There's hardly anyone in the crowd. Shanghai, of course, is where he had his incident, isn't it, with Zverev, Misha Zverev, a couple of years ago.
Yes.
And Kyrgios has been beaten anyway, 6-3 in the third.
He also did a thing, which I wasn't going to mention because I just don't think he deserves the airtime. But he did a thing last week, didn't he, where he earnestly said in press that a doubles player whose name escapes me, not one I'd heard of, I must admit, was now his coach. And he said, you can quote me on that, he is my coach. And then everybody wrote about it and quoted him on it, because people take an interest in Nick Kyrgios and wish him well and want him to flourish in his career, because in the words of Mohamed Leani, he's good for tennis. And then he took the piss out of everyone for writing about him, took the piss out of the media for being gullible, because that bloke isn't his coach. And I just thought, it was sneery, and I just felt like, okay, we won't give two hoots about you then, Nick. We won't write about what's going on with you. Why should we care if you're going to make fun of us for caring?
I do think
it really annoyed me. I know he thought it was just a little prank, and I know Andy Murray did something similar on April Fool's Day about Ross Hutchins being his coach, but it just felt sneery and misjudged, and I just big time eye rolled and just thought, Nick, you're tennis-wise, you're an irrelevance. People will stop writing about this stuff, and then it's not going to be very funny.
Well, he does need some results soon, because people are starting to not take interest, actually, now, it seems to me, because nothing's happening. Nothing's happened this year in his career, really. Stan Wawrinka's just been beaten by Borna Coric, who's also had a steady progression this year. He's actually made some real strides. So a few results there from Shanghai, as they happen here on the Tennis Podcast. Irrelevant.
Live, seem to be out of date tennis news that you could just look up on the internet.
Great.
That's what the people come here for.
Let's sell the show. That's what I say.
A couple of other bits and bobs, David.
Kevin Anderson, what a great bloke. How about that?
Yeah, Kevin Anderson in Being a Great Bloke news. Not news, but, you know, latest installment of Kevin Anderson being a great bloke. He was thanked by also lovely bloke, Matt Ebden, on social media because he, Anderson, agreed to play their match on Wednesday, a day later than I think was proposed, in a gesture to give Ebden more time to recover from his illness. And Matt Ebden said, quote, authentic people with character are hard to find. Not too sure how many people out there would do that. He's absolutely right. I'm not sure there are too many people, even, you know, the good eggs out there. Their competitive juices might prevent them from such a gesture. And yeah, was it last week or a couple of weeks ago that we were talking about the fact that there are disappointingly few in tennis that are prepared to stand up for anything? And for that reason, Kevin Anderson really stands out and deserves credit. And yeah, he's a lovely bloke, isn't he?
I remember that happening once before, by the way, about, crikey, we're going back 25 years to Miami final, Pete Sampras against Andre Agassi. And which one of them was it? Sampras got a stomach bug. That was it. Sampras got a stomach bug and Agassi agreed to delay the final so that they could still play it. And Sampras ended up beating him, which was a bit of a shame for old Andre. But anyway, it was a nice move. We've also got...
Do you know what that reminds me of? I don't think I can say the names... but two players on the Champions Tour playing a final. And one was really struggling with injury, couldn't serve at full strength. And the other would probably have beaten him anyway because was the stronger, younger player. But, you know, as is the way on the Champions Tour, you know, it's an exhibition circuit. The stronger, uninjured player, started being very, very kind to the injured player and took it into a Champions tiebreak, made it look competitive, and the other one went ahead and turned it on for the Champions tiebreak, won the thing, and I saw the runners-up trophy being thrown in the bin backstage afterwards.
Who are the players?
Am I allowed to say?
I don't know. Who are they?
Well, I don't know. This might actually be groundbreaking news because this might get edited out, mightn't it? But the one that did the bad thing or the alleged bad thing was Stefan Edberg. Ooh. Repeated winner of the Stefan Edberg Sportsmanship Award. And the runner-up trophy in the bin player was Goran Ivanišević. Runner-up trophy in the bin is one of my favourite Champions Tour memories ever.
Sensational. Love it. Okay. Right. Well, what else we got to talk about? Fed Cup and backhands.
Yeah. Fed Cup is coming to...
Coming home.
It's coming. Is that a thing? It's coming to the UK. The British are coming.
Yes.
They were hosting it for the first time since 1993. So the top group of the Europe Africa Zone will play at Bath University, my mother's alma mater. Lovely city, Bath, in February. Lovely. It's great news.
That is nice. That is really. And hat tip to my good friend and colleague at Queen's, Stephen Farrar, who now looks after all the competition and tournament side of things at in British tennis, and he actually was quite instrumental in arranging that. So no
brilliant,
great surprise
well done
there.
Him. And it feels right because we, Great Britain, have been so unlucky with draws for the Fed Cup in terms of always having away ties. Always, we haven't had a stage in the UK for women's team tennis for goodness knows how long. Certainly not since, you know, Joe Konta rose to prominence, which is such a shame.
Yeah.
So
it's come
yeah.
so close. So well done, yeah. Stephen Farrar.
Well done, Stephen Farrar.
What else have we got to talk about? One-handed
well,
backhands.
Well, we've not got much
backhands.
Time left yet, and I know you want to talk about one-handed backhands, but I want to talk about Joe Konta's dog.
Right. So, okay. Should we delay one-handed backhands against two-handed backhands then?
Well, you can.
Andy Murray's had his say about. It was quite funny. Everybody's always waxing on about how beautiful a single-handed backhand is, and I'm just as guilty as anybody. And Andy Murray on his Instagram page decided he would like to state the case for the double-handed backhand. He said, "I'm here to stick up for double-handers. The one-handers are always said to be more beautiful, more artistic and poetic, but almost all the best backhands in the game are double-handers." Controversial. "Almost all coaches say they would teach a double-handed backhand because it's a more simple, effective and efficient technique. Art doesn't need to be complex. There is beauty in simplicity. Double-handers for the win." What do you think, Catherine?
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with what he says. I'm aware that coaches would teach a double-handed backhand. It's more simple, effective, efficient, da-di-da. Yes, almost all the best backhands in the game are double-handers. Don't disagree with any of that. There are some all-time brilliant double-handers out there. The jump double-handed backhand is a thing of beauty. I always think of Marit Safin when I think of that shot, but there are plenty of hit it beautifully over the years. But if I had to choose between the very best double hander and the very best single hander on aesthetics and artistic basis, I would go for the single hander. And I defy anyone who hasn't seen that slow motion shot of Shapovalov hitting a jump single handed backhand. Just make sure you've seen that before you decide. But I've got double hander.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant.
I've got a single hander and it's better.
Shoddy. Yeah.
We haven't had our rematch yet.
Do you ever hit it topspin though, David, or is it always slice? You do.
I do.
All right, okay.
I mean, I have to say, during my match against Simon last week, it took me about 45 minutes to try one topspin backhand, because my slice was A, going so well, and B, I was too scared. And then when I did do a drive backhand, it did hit the back fence.
I can't bear people that only chip or slice their backhand. I can't bear it.
It must
be like playing Greg Rozetsky.
Yeah.
Are you the Greg Rozetsky of Henley and whatever tennis club?
I'm the Greg Rozetsky of Hackersville, is what I am.
Right then, David, we're running out of time.
Right. What do you want to talk about?
Do you agree with me on what I say about what's your position?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think Andy Murray makes quite a convincing argument. And I think of people like Andre Agassi for a two-hander. I just think he's got such a reliable backhand. You know, I tend to think that the
double-hander
is that much more...
There's nothing sexy about reliability, David. That's not what we're talking about.
Well, that's lovely, isn't it? All us lovely, reliable people out there.
I'm not. It's a value, but we're not talking about that, are we?
Right.
We're talking about beauty, artistry, and poeticism. Those are Andy Murray's words.
I can only say what I said at the start of the topic, which is that when I'm commentating, I bang on about the single-handed backhand being a thing of beauty, and it. Sorry, Andy, you're wrong.
Joe Conta's got a new dog, David. I don't think my words can do it justice, so I would urge you just to go on social media and look into, what's it called, Bobo? Bobo's deep blue eyes,
Bobo.
As I spent most of my weekend doing. It's beautiful. It's a great dog. It's a Dachshund.
Okay.
Lovely.
Okay.
And Agnieszka Radwanska, David, has opened a hotel. An Agnieszka Radwanska themed hotel.
Joy.
Where each of the boutique rooms is themed according to one of her most successful tournaments. So there's a Wimbledon room.
Do you have to crouch down on your haunches to get into every room?
I don't know.
Like she's hitting one of her forehands.
Yeah, I don't know. But the pictures of it made me hoot with laughter. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. She looks like she's having a whale of a time. It's great. I'm not sure I actually want to. Do I want to stay there? I don't know. Maybe I desperately do want to stay there.
Just for Anyways, social media.
If
value.
You want to stay there, it's in Krakow.
We could record a tennis podcast in the Radwanska
Okay.
Hotel.
Right. I'm I'm all of a sudden convinced. Would you want the Wimbledon room or the Beijing room? I don't think there is a Birmingham room.
No.
Hang on a second. Did she win Birmingham ever?
Don't think so.
No. Birmingham didn't make it.
No.
God, how would you decorate a Birmingham themed room, David?
How would you
decorate it?
She might still win it, who knows? You'd get a chicken ball too for a start, and you would you'd get an amazing football team wearing blue and white stripes on the wallpaper, and yeah, that's about it really.
You'd get John Terry in there, maybe.
Yeah, no.
And Thierry Henry. Yeah.
No.
Right then, David, we've strayed again. It's time to get this show on the road, or off the road. Let's get this show off the road. We've been the Tennis Podcast, David, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, with our executive producers, Melanie Bowes, SSSTennisBalls.com, with La Manga Club, where our competition winners, David, have been enjoying their wonderful holiday this weekend. They look like they've had a lovely time.
I mean, surely we haven't really worked that out too well. We should have had that holiday for ourselves. That looks like a fantastic trip.
It really looks good, doesn't it? Really looks good. But yes.
Congratulations to Chris and Olivia.
Yes, absolutely. And Olivia's been that. Olivia, who looks quite heavily pregnant now, photographed on the tennis court. So that baby is playing from the womb.
Wearing the Tennis Podcast T-shirt.
Champion in the making.
Yeah, you can get your own Tennis Podcast T-shirt and sweatshirt and hoodie.
And are actively encouraged to do so.
Yeah, on our website.
Nick Kyrgios has lost, by the way, from a setup, loses to world number 104, Bradley Klan, did not react well to his effort being questioned by umpire Damien Dumoussoir. That is hot off the press from Stuart Fraser.
Right.
And that leaves us only, David, to mention our beloved mascot, Charlie the Ferret. We, David, will be back next week. Thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.